Well, thank you very much, Sally Oldfield, for joining me today. I want to kind of give context to who you are to me, because we came across each other in COVID.
We did.
And I have had a chance to say thank you, but when we started working together, I think we reached out about doing some recruitment or whatever it was in Dublin.
Yeah, I think it was, wasn't it? I can't really remember how we made that leap. Yes.
You then became my kind of creative operation, kind of business godmother of sorts. And then for about 9 months or whatever the season was, we worked together on trying to bring Good Brains to Good Brands alive.
We did.
And you did that completely.
You worked on it mostly. I just hung around in the background a bit.
I didn't know what I was doing, and it sort of played out that I really didn't know what I was doing.
You did a very good job of making it seem like you did.
Thank you.
Yes.
But the main purpose of bringing that up is because I think it goes to show the level of kindness, but also quality of your experience. Because for those that don't know you, you are someone that came from client services, obviously spent a bit of time doing a bit of producing, but you had the mammoth task of, I always describe it as reversing an independent agency into a consultancy, we're going to call it?
Yes, major corporate.
A major corporate, right. So you've got super creative people going into super numbers people, and you were caught in a crossfire. And I'm not going to dive into that just yet.
No, no.
But when I saw that you had been through that, I thought, wow, this lady must have seen and heard a whole load of stuff. but yeah. I want to, before we get into all that, I'm going to ask you our originating question. And that is, before all of this, who was the first person that made you feel like you were talented?
Yeah, I think about this.
Okay.
Because I have a very personal answer and then a kind of work answer. Personal answer is definitely my dad, because my dad, from really early age, and some of my earliest memories are about him making me do things. So he thinks that I can do anything, and still in his very old age, he believes that. He's often pushed me to do things that I didn't think I could do, just in his own sort of gentle way.
What did you do to make that happen when you were a kid?
I don't know. Just very determined, I think, and also prepared to try anything. So my earliest memory of knowing that I had some sort of talent was him getting me to kill a fish. That's my earliest memory of him, like, you can do anything, you can definitely do this and try. You've got it in you to try anything, and it's worth trying anything. So it's just a characteristic of our relationship. He was like, well, why don't you give it a go?
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, my career is quite varied, I was a producer. I started working in creative industry in my teens, rose to producer. And that's where I think the professional people who originally made me think that I had some talent. A woman called Kai Lu Sheng and a director called Ronnie West, who, when I was 21, were like, you should be producing, which at 21 is really daunting. You still feel like you're not that long out of university and you still feel like a kid and like you don't know anything. I learn quickly, and I think that's what they could see. And they at that point, they'd said, there's some music videos that we think you ought to have a go at, and we'll stand behind you and we'll support you all of the way, but you really ought to try it. Which is daunting at 21, running a set. Now kind of title producer is sort of, can be anybody at any age, but it wasn't then, which is kind of late 90s, I guess.
I think what I like about that is the risk that they've taken, because for anybody, we love asking this question, or I like asking this question, because somebody, in order to make somebody feel like they have talent, has told someone quite junior, or given them an experience and chance to experience, fucking it up.
Yes, and I think that was my biggest fear.
Right.
I kind of have memories of those situations being so tied up in knots, as in, I will fuck this up. I will have done. And production is it's so rigorous. You have to be so on it, and you have so much responsibility that because when anything goes wrong, I mean, every minute costs you a lot of money. And yeah, I probably wandered around for probably years in my early producing career worrying about those things, but trying to hold it together. Anyway, yeah, so after producing, I moved into client services when I had a baby. And production is just not a world for women, particularly not at that time.
Why? Who told you that you could make that jump? And did you have an idea in your head where you wanted to get to with that move?
Nobody told me. I think I've always enjoyed being that other half of a sort of creative duo, in being the realizing side of things. Mm. And I sort of figured out that I could make the leap from working with directors as being the person who made it happen. Mm. I could do the same with designers. And that would be more of a sort of steady career. So that's at the point in my career where I switched from advertising into design. But no, nobody told me. I just was like, well, I love this industry. I don't know any different. And at that point, what was that? I'd been 27, 28, something like that. It made sense. And from there, then, the world of client services, it sort of, of course, I knew it because I've been working in commercial production and advertising. But I had never thought, oh, that's for me. But as soon as I saw that actually the strategic component was also part of that, like, right, okay, I can definitely use my brain a bit harder. And from there, pretty much pursued that sort of hybrid client service project management and then worked my way up to management position. It took a while.
Which was the bit that you felt like you had a superpower in? Because to get to that position and then suddenly be given the reins to manage, which I want to speak about.
Yeah.
Which bit were you better than anybody else at, would you say?
Oh, I think the kind of, somebody said to me the other day, I said, I've figured you out. You're an endurance athlete, aren't you? You can stick with it and you can go and be resolute and keep your eye on absolutely what the goal is. I think that sort of patience, resilience, the sticking with the client no matter what, which might, I don't want that to sound like it's sort of submissive, because that's not what I mean at all, but if working with your client through the highs and the lows and helping them realize their goal as well. I'm pretty good at that. I'm pretty good at reading creative people as well and being able to anticipate or unpick what it is that they have in their vision to try and make that happen without stepping into their world too much.
Which is the art of a good client services person.
I think so, yeah. You need to know which side of the line you're on at all times. So.
There are opposites to that are also successful. So what I want to know what the opposite of a good client services person would be to your style, but they still get somewhere, arguably sometimes quicker.
Oh, probably somebody who is just absolutely chasing the pennies and the bottom line. I think that, there are features of client service that's all you're there to do. Is just get it to the finish line, just get the job done, make as much margin as possible, as opposed to make really good margin and make really good product.
That feels like the most consistent way of seeing progression within client services people, right? You normally get the ones that are really good at selling stuff to the clients. They're very happy with it, but the work for some reason suffers a little bit.
Yeah.
But the incredible client services people, the ones that have worked at wherever, Droga5, Widens, have somehow managed to please both audiences.
Yeah.
The crazy idea was bought, it did really well, and the client was super happy.
But I think that comes from my production training, because I was trained quite rigorously when I was at RSA Films. And you never lose sight of that. And particularly, you know, institution like that with kind of Ridley's name over the door, you can't let anybody down on the quality or the actual, the impact of what it is that you're creating. So I think it stood me in good stead taking that slightly weird path being a producer to then becoming, account management, basically.
Which was the bit where you felt like you were fully energized, as in before, I'm going to say before management, because I think that you have to make some sacrifices when you get there.
You do.
When were you feeling like, wow, I'm in this?
Let me think about that one for a second. I feel fully energized every single project, and I still do. And I run a design agency currently, and we have the most incredible briefs come through the door, and I feel fully energized every time. It's like, wow, this is the most incredible world-changing opportunity or business, and I've got no hesitation about wanting to pitch for it.
Does it have to be world-changing to energize you?
No, sometimes it's much softer than that. But
what is the common denominator to energize you because if you're saying that every project, nearly every project that you're
nearly
working
every
on,
project.
We're going to say, right?
Oh,
There
are plenty of others where you're like, God, yeah, really, I don't know why on earth we're even thinking about this, but yeah.
What's the common denominator, do you think, in a good project?
In a good project, it's always people with vision. It's no question.
What does that mean?
I think people who really own their work and they really own the goal that they're seeking. And you can tell when people are just spinning the wheels and going through the motions on things. And I think because obviously I spent a bit of time back in advertising, and a lot of that work was of that nature, as in we have to do something because we have to spend the budget and we've got to build on last year's campaign, but we don't want to do anything that is, too much of a departure from what we've already done. And also we're just sitting on our jobs and we're taking no risks. Right. And you know that that's just service, as opposed to creation. Maybe that might sound a bit pretentious, but the difference is an idea, a vision, a goal, doing something that it's going to make an impact.
Yes.
It doesn't matter whether that impact is shifting X amount more product or whether it is bringing a new product in the world.
So you're more, if we have clarity and we have a vision of what clear vision of what that thing is that we're trying to achieve, I'm in it, as long as it's not fossil fuels or something that's really bad for the planet.
Yeah, yeah.
And the team that I'm surrounded by to achieve that goal,
yeah.
If I believe that they're aligned to our vision,
yes.
I'm in.
Yeah, yeah.
And I will be my endurance athlete in
this.
And
I will be an endurance athlete in, and I will bring them all with me, and I will stand behind all of them when they need that, sort of pushing up the hill.
I want to ask a little bit about your movement into management and what somebody saw in you. Do you think take that bet and say, Sally, we're going to move you into a managerial role?
Yeah.
What do you think they saw in you?
Probably some of that. I stepped from a client service director's head account management role into, a sort of junior-ish COO role and then moved upwards. I think the CEO I made that move with at the time, he knew that what I was walking into was going to be a minefield. It was going to be very difficult. I walked into an agency that was in the early days of pre-acquisition with one of the major consultancies. And he knew how hard the path was going to be. And he also knew how difficult and how fractious and how bad-tempered the management team was within the agency. And so, he needed somebody who, he told me actually, he was like, I wanted to employ somebody who was as radically different from us as I could possibly find. At some point, one of the other founders of the agency said, "It's like you." He said, "It's like you're from out of space." And why have you ended up here? And I'm very glad you have ended up here. Yeah. But yeah, we needed that level of difference, and we needed that level of, I don't even know what like corralling, like positively corralling, to push us all towards this goal, which was a big sale. And to try and hold everybody together through it, so that, because going through an acquisition and then going into an integration from a, yeah, sort of fairly fiercely independent creative shop into yeah, a corporate major is, so many analogies came up through the process of doing it, you know, marriages of convenience and oil and water and all this sort of stuff. But we just had to get everybody through the hardest part.
How do you define if it's been a successful merger? So that we're talking about Accenture acquiring Rothko in Dublin.
Yeah.
Just very similar to how Accenture acquired Calm Rama or Droga5. These are highly creative agencies that have just done flying by the seat of your pants kind of creative work. Probably not that au fait with loads of processes and structures.
No, you're very right.
Ask 90% of the people in the building, generally none of them will know about the bottom line either. Number one, what was the biggest challenge? And number two, how were you judging its success post-merger to see if it did well?
What was the first question again?
What was the biggest challenge?
What was the biggest challenge? The biggest challenge is when you run an independent business and you can absolutely do things on your own terms and you have that freedom of decision-making that allows you to take risks, kill things when they're not working, be quite radically creative at times, to fuck stuff off when you don't want to do it any longer, I mean, to resign accounts even, or to carve your own path. So the biggest challenge was uniting that with the corporate regime of a major with 500,000 employees and at the time a $39 billion market cap. So and any very, very large organization has to run a lot of systems and a lot of process and a lot of policy. So that was the biggest thing, was trying to insert, I suppose, all of the non-negotiable things that would have to start happening. And some of them are very good things. You think about the good governance of large companies, or, you know, sometimes the way that they treat people better, or they've bigger scale, so they've got ability to make more positive impact when they want to use their money for doing good. But it was, the biggest challenge was trying to put those two things together, because the loss of autonomy and control of an independent agency owner in the face of, well, I've just got now just part of the system.
Yeah.
I think it's heartbreaking. And you know yourself when you don't know exactly where you're going and you feel like somebody else has control, but they don't really understand you and they don't really know where they're going either. It's very disorientating. So that was the big one. And then keeping the people acquisitions, sometimes you're only keeping people in a satisfactory place.
How do you sell satisfactory?
It's really hard. It's really hard. I mean, because, you're always sort of holding out the, and there's the possibility of this without actually ever being able to confirm anything. And you do feel a bit duplicitous sometimes.
Yeah. But how do you, I want to ask just like one question on this, because I want to move into the creative industry. And I'm going to ask you to get your crystal ball out in a second. But just on that, I've always thought that when an acquisition happens, the great people, the mavericks, will go, and then typically the more obedient people will stay. How did you maintain or stop that from happening?
Yeah. From the mavericks from going? Mm. Well, in the instance I was in, they didn't. I mean, don't forget that actually being a maverick in a large corporation is quite an exciting place to be, as long as you've got enough kind of hardness in yourself to be able to put up with the, we couldn't possibly do that. It's far too dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, fucking with the system, if you're a maverick, I think is quite interesting.
You're selling it to me now. I can see how you did that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be okay. Yeah. Like, be provocative, but don't be too provocative.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, you've worked at a variety of different design agencies and advertising agencies, selling branding, rebrands, and all that kind of stuff, and then communication campaigns. What do you think's changed in the last decade?
Mm.
And where do you see more change to be happening in those disciplines particularly?
What's changed in the last decade? I mean, convergence of services.
What does that mean to me?
What does that mean to you? The sort of great big smushing of creative agencies that can sort of do anything.
Right.
This sort of bizarre idea that you can offer a 360 service because technology allows you to do that. I mean, the thing that always falls off, I see it when people are like, it might be a design agency, we've got this incredible opportunity and it includes some advertising and we can definitely do some of the advertising, and you're sort of thinking, I don't know if you can. And then there's a need for some media buying. What would we do about that? I mean, that's where the sort of big smushing of things, I think, begins to show that it isn't totally possible. So when I say convergence of services, it is that. It is big shops, little shops, being able to cross the entire spectrum of creative services, creative delivery, strategy at one end, all the way to the thing to finish campaigns at the other, or finish branding even, and brand books. I mean, there is that strange sort of intersection you get where advertising agencies think that they can be designers and vice versa. And I don't hold it to be true. I think there's probably a middle space for smaller scale work where it happens positively sometimes. So I think there's been that convergence. I think the thing that I'm seeing at the minute is quite large clients having changed their perception about the size of agencies that they will and can work with. Much smaller agencies and much younger agencies get a look in, I think, on bigger work.
What's changed for that to be the case?
I was talking to somebody about it recently. I think some of it's client trust. Some of it is client fatigue, as in fatigue of dealing with the big, slow, bloated, expensive, systematized nature of very large agencies, which I mean hopefully anybody who's listening who works in one of those knows exactly what I mean. It seems to take forever to get anything done, and hordes of people to do even the smallest thing. And I think that's down to agencies' business models. But I think to the other end, clients, even fairly large clients, know that they can get exceptional creative results from people who've not been in the game for decades and don't have huge shops and don't have huge service costs that reflect in their fees. So there's a perception change on the client side to an extent. I don't know if that answers your question.
That does. It segues me very nicely into a concept that you're aware of.
Okay.
This is that nobody wants to work for you.
Yes.
Not you. I mean, everyone wants to work for you and with you, for that matter. But nobody wants to work for you. So we sat in that room, right? And we pulled together 8 to 10 CMOs, CEOs, creatives, doers and leaders.
Yeah.
And we asked them the very open question, why would nobody want to work for an agency or a brand in 2023? And we sat around and we had this whole workshop thing.
Yeah.
This section really that I wanted to kind of focus the podcast on is being honest about that. And actually, yeah. I'd love to ask you that question. If you are in 2023, which you are, yes. why would you not want to work for an agency now if you have a very strategic or creative brain?
Yeah, I think because I see it, and I see it in the kind of base of people who I work with currently. being pinned down, being, and I hate this word, being treated like an asset and not like a human, or being treated like a unit. Mm-hmm. So somebody who can get something done as opposed to somebody whose creative contribution is really valuable. I think the ever-changing nature of teams, because holding a team together across a project consistently when you've got resource pressures or you've got constant change pressures coming from the client side or perhaps also from new business, which means that teams get switched in and out. You never really want to do that, but sometimes it happens. So there's that, the mm-hmm. unit side of it. I think there is the myth of agency culture being like the finest place to work and isn't it great? And we all hang out together and go to the pub and have fun at work. Pandemic put paid to that. It's not to say that it's completely evaporated. Mm. I still think, you know, there are strong cultures where you get really, really bonded relationships between the people you employ. What else? I sometimes think it's the very nature of the work, and it's the level of client input versus perhaps mavericks who would like much more creative autonomy. I think because, you know, collaborative working culture, clients' roles have changed, you know, so much more is expected of them, and you know, agencies for a long time have said, you know, we have very, very collaborative processes, absolutely get involved. Mm. If you think about how the way technology is produced, and that requires, you know, small, very bonded groups of people working very fast together, swapping ideas backwards and forwards, and the client role in that, I think that way of working has definitely changed the way clients work with their agencies, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so there is an expectation of we're all one and the same. And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's negative. And I think for people who need the or want some of the kind of maverick creative autonomy to just let me go away and let me come up with something, it's really hard for them to work like that.
Mm.
So I'm culture, unitization, changing the way of working.
Okay, because the culture unitization, that's it's a very clever way of putting what I was trying to say in my head then. But all I see is that agencies were once selling culture, huge creative opportunity, a way to get famous and show your mum ads or designs or logos or whatever you've done with your career. And that has changed. And I think the reason people are joining those agencies has changed.
Yeah.
Get in my little wagon, my little going to the future wagon, go forward 2 years right now. Who are the best agencies? Because it's hard to predict that. I'm sure you'd say accept and proceed with one of them. But tell me about the agency of the future. What are they doing differently? How are they approaching their staff retention differently?
Yeah.
How are they approaching how they sell work differently?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Agency of the future and what they're doing. I had a really interesting conversation with a client recently about the fallacy of creative education. And he was really calling out that the sort of age of what he called design erudition is coming to an end.
What's design erudition?
Design erudition being the tradition in which designers are educated,
mm-hmm.
Which it does when you think about it, it feels like it, you know, a lot of it is based on the mid-century, and I'm not saying that there is anything wrong with that, but a creative education as it belongs to fairly privileged, so certainly a class issue here, those individuals who are able to go to one of the, you know, top universities for a design education. It is the same design education that was being delivered 20, 30 years ago. And those principles are beginning to break down. I'm not obviously not speaking as a designer, but he was speaking as somebody who commissions a huge amount of design, saying that that's not necessarily fit for purpose any longer, because where creativity is coming from and where it is most original and it's most interesting is outside of those worlds of people who've had that kind of education. So he was talking about, you know, creator communities who are much more DIY, who are much more self-sufficient, who maybe haven't come through the education system, haven't even gone through kind of agency, you know, levels of figuring out this, well, this is what an agency does and how it does it and what have you. So going back to the future, and I think what will change is the where talent comes from, I think, has to change. When I referred a minute ago to this sort of class thing, and also particularly in the design world, for a long time there's kind of like two schools of thought that you can't possibly be a designer if you haven't had a design education. And then there are others who are like, no, you can absolutely learn on the job, but there's definitely fewer of those. And I just think that balance might start to tip slightly. Does that answer your question?
It answers my question. I think we definitely hear a lot that the location of these people needs to change, or where we're finding them needs to change. Yes. How
you employ them, I think, has to change.
Yeah, that's what I think we have to do work on ourselves before we start to go, oh, look, I found this one from wherever. Yeah. Come into our culture.
Yeah.
Then they get rejected from that culture because they haven't got the Falmouth degree or whatever it is.
Exactly. And the thing is that, again, I go to how technology has changed things. I mean, the ability to hybridize is much more present than it used to be. So you could be a designer, you might also code, you might also be able to edit and art direct. So you can make film as well as complete visual design, as well as work in digital design as well. And those hybrids in, I think, like, you know, second generation agencies, quite hard for them. And they also, they don't necessarily want to be pinned down. I mean, why would you want to go and work in an agency where you're working for the same client 37 and a half hours a week when you could be freelance and you could do that as you please and make films in your evening time and actually enjoy exploring your creative practice. Because, you know, agency life, I think, takes that out of people.
Yeah.
We both know that. It's hard. And, yeah, people, even today, still work crazy hours.
Yeah. I'm happy with that.
Okay.
I'm going to move on a little bit because I want to hear your thoughts on this, particularly as you are a female leader. I just want to kind of myth bust a little bit here.
Yeah.
You said something to me once that really struck me. I'm not sure if I didn't perceive it in the right way, but I certainly, after inhaling things like Brené Brown and the power of vulnerability and that kind of stuff, we spoke about being a female leader. And I think you said this, or at least this is what I got. You said the frustrating thing about being a female leader is that people rely on you for the traits that the other male leaders perhaps might not have, be it empathy or compassion, whereas actually as a female leader, you possess many other traits, many masculine traits like assertiveness or whatever else that we attribute to men or males. Did you remember saying that, and can you elaborate more on that point?
Did I remember saying that?
Even if you don't, sort of pretend you do.
Because I was thinking about what was going through my head when I would have said that to you. I think as well as relying on feminine traits is also relying on women to do shitty jobs that men don't want to do or are particularly bad at, and a lot of that comes down on the people side as well. That I find really frustrating. The why I said that is because as a female leader, you are not the same as a male leader, but people assume that you should be the same because that is what they know and that is what they have seen for such a very, very long time. But you have different balance in those strengths. So, for example, sort of classic male management style, which, of course, you know, as a female leader, you're not going to pretend that you're going to, that you either want to do that or that you can do that, or that that's even the right way of doing things. Forthright, outspoken, visibly determined, I'm kind of going into cliches here.
Yes,
but why is it okay to assume that women in leadership would want to behave that way or should behave that way when actually doing things in a more considered way, looking at the entire picture, not making decisions based on, something that has happened in the moment or is a fragment of a detail, not thinking about the whole person or all of the people when you perhaps have to make tough decisions. I'm perhaps losing my train of thought slightly here, but I think current management role and my previous management role, I've been questioned on both occasions of, well, why do you not seem to be doing something about it? Like, I am doing something about it. You just can't see it because I am doing it in the background and I am making sure that either these people are all right or the company is all right. I am just not getting up on some soapbox and sort of, whipping it all into kind of motivated, energized, action. Of course you do that, but you might do it individually with lots and lots of people, as opposed to sort of stand on your soapbox.
Wow, that's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah, and women choose to do some things much faster than men and some things slower.
Mm.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. So on the industry as a whole, there was a thing that went out in Campaign recently, speaking about how we're nowhere near the 50-50 split for male and female. There's a very well-documented conversation around shared parental leave and supporting parenthood, and I think we are making progress on that. I think we've just changed parental policy. Not, I was going to call it pat leave then, but that's wrong. I'm looking at my head of people right now and she's staring me in the eyes.
Parental or paternity?
Parental.
Yeah.
Into a more of a shared parental leave policy, right?
Yeah.
It's very similar to the Scandinavians. I feel like that level of conversation has had a good amount of coverage. Do you see there as any other problems when it comes to anything else stopping females wanting to become leaders apart from becoming a mother?
Apart from becoming a mother. There's this interesting study that was done in the States recently. And it's quite shocking, the stats that are coming out of it about the number of women who have been given the opportunity to be leaders but have actually decided that they don't want to do it. So the question is, how do we encourage them, or
what's the block
if it's not motherhood? I think a lot of the block is never being able to see yourself in that position already. I was talking to a few of my peers recently about whether we'd ever had a female boss, and I'm in my 40s, so you would hope that things changed enough that I would have done, but I've never worked for a female CEO.
Really?
Yeah. Again, it's a cliche, but if you don't see it, then, or if you see women who've been, who are in management or leadership positions who are behaving like men and are completely phony, why would you want to be like that?
Yes.
There's a bit of visibility problem, and I think also something of a kind of character problem. And going back to this, women leaving leadership positions in America in quite large quantities, I think it is, you also get to that point sometimes where you think, well, as you, feminine view of the world is different. I don't know if your outlook is broader or quite what, and I'm generalizing, obviously. But occasionally you get to that point and you think, okay, so I'm here. Why do I want to be here? Why do I want to, churn it day in and day out? And as a woman, deal with some of the shittier problems in business. And I think, it's that feminine trait of taking huge amounts of responsibility, not being able to let it go. Why would I want to be here? Is it actually worth it? And so, there is a dialogue, I think, that needs to encourage women. Well, actually, let's scratch that bit for a second. There are many, many dialogues encouraging women into leadership, but nobody actually telling you why it's a good thing to do. I mean, you get the position and the influence and the money, but when it comes down to it, what does it actually mean?
What does a job actually mean? What does it actually mean? Do you think we see enough feminine leadership? So we see females being promoted into leadership roles. Do we see enough celebration of all it means to be feminine? I was just having a conversation with Hannah, our head of people in the walk here. She was speaking about, Jacinda, who is relevant to where you're from in the world.
Indeed.
And she stepped down as prime minister, and she I think Hannah was saying that she cried when the Christchurch thing happened. There's a whole load of stuff where she's displaying what it is to be a female, not just in, like you were saying, the borrowing the masculine traits and saying, I'm like Donald Trump, I'm a female. She's crying and she's demonstrating what it is to be more empathetic and compassionate. Do you think we see enough of that? And my next question is, do you ever do anything yourself to, show off feminine leadership style?
So, do we see enough of that? Do we see enough of kind of women truly being women in leadership roles?
Mm-hmm.
No, because I think the kind of the myth still prevails that you've got to keep a lid on it. You've got to be as kind of here's the thing: you have to work harder than men. In that you have to do more to sort of be upstanding and calm and fair and unflappable, because you've got to do that and you've got to deal with all of the shitty stuff as well. And you're also fulfilling your kind of personal side of it, which is to look after things in a different and a deeper way. So you are working harder.
I really agree, because if I cry as a man, as a male leader, I get told I'm being brave. You get told you're weak.
Completely. If you shout, or if you get annoyed, or if you are trying to sort something out and it's quite difficult and you need to be quite firm, you're the axe woman.
Yeah, she's crazy.
Exactly. Or you're this, completely emotionless bitch. You're just doing what you need to do in your role. And you're not adopting any kind of masculine persona in order to do it. You are doing what you need to do. But I've been in multiple situations where you are assertive. You are either patted on the head or you're told off. That doesn't change that much.
How do we... Okay, and I'm going to... I won't push
you. Sorry, that
wasn't...
We didn't answer the other question, but we can move on.
I wanted just to say, is there anything you can call out of yourself to stop that from happening and to speed up the progression for acceptance of feminine leadership in its whole form. What can I do, you do, anyone do?
Well, I mean, bring more women up and stand behind them and be honest with them that, I'm having to behave this way because I'm just trying to get through within the system that we have, but I want you to know that you don't have to do this. So you might see two sides of me. You might see the side which is having to kind of conform more to male management type, but you'll know that when I talk with you directly about how we do things together and how I support you into, you know, management or leadership roles, that I want you to be more like that and less like this. Less like the kind of sort of more archaic version. But it definitely is about pushing and keeping more women in their roles. There's no question. I don't think there's anything new there. But you've got to work really hard at it.
I think you've really smashed that. Another subject that I'm kind of interested in, particularly in the nobody wants to work for you vein, is we're having a whole load of young people coming into this industry. They could set up a TikTok account and become a millionaire over the course of 4 weeks. They could start whatever they want, right? But a lot of them are saying they want to be involved in the creative industry. If you were a young creative person coming into the creative industries, design, creative, production, whatever it is, which skills would you tell them to focus on developing, do you think?
If you look at the quality of talent that comes in and you look at their hybrid skills and you look at how quickly new knowledge is gained, but that's all applied knowledge, applied skills. So it will be, you know, things that allow you to kind of execute in your job. And that's fine. And I would absolutely say to anybody is like, don't discount anything. We mentioned design erudition earlier. Do not get stuck in the trap of design erudition that you only do one thing really well. Lovely to be able to do that, but go and take up pottery or something of that nature, because our industry demands and increasingly demands the ability to be much more multidisciplinary. So I would say that, you know, keep your mind open about the executional side of things, so the applied skills, but work on the soft skill side of things. And the reason why, and what I mean by that is ability to work with others, collaboration skills, focus and resilience skills, because although, you know, the industry is changing and it is becoming, and I hope, becoming more human-centric and respectful of people, both for who they are and the talents that they have, it's still hard. And, you know, if your creativity is what you sell and what you live, and there is that sort of fuzzy line between work and life and play, when you get knocked back in a creative discipline, I think it's incredibly hard. I've seen it my entire career, but I see it a lot with younger creatives who, they've either graduated through the pandemic, perhaps they've come to work later, for example. And the rejection thing is particularly difficult for them. But if you can work on those soft things of, being able to get through when times are tough, the kind of interpersonal skills side of it as well, I would say, make sure that you don't miss that out. And you could miss that out, because there is a demand for such hybridization of capability. Does that make sense?
That does make sense.
Okay.
What you're saying is kind of work with people in a way, like to learn, like to learn your...
Just don't ever forget that that's half of what we do. Yeah. I mean, agencies are, you know, they're thin air businesses and they are only as good as their people are. And yeah, we've come through the pandemic and lots of people have been completely on their own. Mm. And working in, you know, kind of fast and quite demanding space with lots of other people and often quite a lot of personalities. Yeah, you have to be fairly steeled, I think, to get through it some of the time. But
I think that's really good advice.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really good. I'm going to move on to Stinky Fish because mm-hmm. I know we haven't got tons of time, but we're going to dive into this. We've asked you to bring along a thing that frustrates you, a thing that you want to leave in a box and it can just blow up. It's like Room 101 with 101.
Yeah.
What did you bring along into your
room? What did I bring along? Well, I read that question and I was like, oh God, I don't know what I'm going to bring. But then it kind of fell into my head. And actually, when we did that session previously, I'd written it down and I happened to find that piece of paper the other day. My stinky fish, the thing that I would absolutely get rid of, is this industry's self-referential, inward-facing, inward-gazing nature around its own self-importance. That, for me, is... It drives me insane. The world is actually a very big place, and there's lots of very, very interesting things going on, but the industry's ability to elevate itself and be self-referential and self-obsessed, when actually, yeah, there are much, much bigger things at play, and people are more important than the industry and the story it tells about itself. That's the stinky fish for me. It's just, even if it just dialed it down a bit, you know.
Is there any specific things that really grind your gear in this sense? Is it LinkedIn? It's LinkedIn, isn't it?
Is it LinkedIn?
Is it Campaign? Is it the drum? Is it Design Week? Or
I don't think you can point to anything specific, but it happens at the individual level, and then it happens at the press trade level, and then it happens at the industry level. And yeah, it's like there is more important work to do in the world, and there are more important things to care about. And yeah,
I look forward to singing you in Cannes. Cool. Well, Sally Oldfield, thank you so much. I have loved this. This has been incredible. I feel like I've got an even better insight into your wonderful brain. So thank you so much.
Nice to be here.
I love your stinky fish.
Thank you for asking me.